This podcast is brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. It also broadcasts throughout the Canterbury region, through the Wairarapa, throughout Taranaki, and throughout the Waikato. So greetings to all listeners in those areas as well. And a very quick reminder to listeners in the Nelson and Tasman areas that we have a wonderful deliberative democracy public meeting with experts from Auckland University's Complex Conversations Unit. It will be held at Putangi Tangi Centre, that's Green Meadows, in Stoke, 5:30 p.m., Wednesday the 5th of August. No admission charge, koha, welcome, snacks will be provided, 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m., 5th of August, Putangi Tangi Centre, Stoke. Right, back to the show. Today we have a very full interview in our Front Footing the Future series, and it's with Dr. Catherine Knight, and here's briefly what we'll cover. We'll debrief the Reality of Everything Symposium, a very successful event that Catherine spearheaded, government policy, decarbonizing transport, deliberative democracy, the need to reinvigorate climate mitigation efforts. How does the ETS fit in? Looking at New Zealand being one of the most wasteful countries in the world, Catherine will talk about her latest book, An Uncommon Land. But I will stop now and let us get on with listening to the interview. Today's guest, Dr. Catherine Knight, needs little introduction as she joined us on Climate Matters earlier in the year. However, to quickly recap, she's an honorary research associate in public policy at Massey University, has an extensive CV and has written a number of acclaimed books, including An Uncommon Land, which is also the name of her Substack newsletter. And most recently, she spearheaded the highly successful Reality of Everything Symposium in late June. A very warm welcome back to Climate Matters, Catherine.
Thank you, Lindsay. Nice to be here.
Wonderful. We're lucky to have you so engaged in it. Thanks, Catherine. Rolling on to the Reality of Everything Symposium, as you know, I was there and I really found it worthwhile, even though I did get trapped in the vile weather that was in Wellington at the time. However, I'd like to start just by asking you to quickly outline for us the form that the symposium took and what were any high-level takeaways from your perspective.
Yes, certainly. So it was a game of two halves, as they say. So the morning part was these what we called expert briefings on a range of topics from climate change, food security, public health, public finance, insurance retreat, te tiriti, etc. Then the afternoon was far more about the engagement of the people there and far more participant-led. So we had a session on deliberative democracy, introducing these tools and hearing a lot from the audience and opening out to discussion. And then there was a session led around transforming reality into action. And that was led by the Wellbeing Economy Alliance Aotearoa. Yeah, so that was the format and some takeaways. Basically, it exceeded my expectations. And a lot of that came down to actually the calibre of the delegates, the people that actually came. And what I also thought was absolutely fantastic and bodes well for continuing this conversation is that people came from across broad sectors of society. So there were people in education and health, there were bankers, there were architects, there were engineers, and of course there were politicians and policymakers. Lots of people actually, especially live streamed in from government departments, interestingly enough. And just so finally, I think my sense from my major takeaway in terms of this high level of demand from people to be there, I think for me it demonstrated that there's a strong appetite for honest conversations about the future. And the final thing I would say, and we'll chat about this a bit more later, is that I've been inundated with requests for follow-up events around the Motu, and including an invitation from members of parliament from both sides of the House, Labor and National, to have an event at parliament next month. So I think that's pretty good.
Well, I hadn't heard that. That's wonderful. And that's also a big credit to you, because it's not always easy to gatecrash into parliament and to get that from both sides. Well done. Rolling on from there, you mentioned that one of the events was a brief exploration of deliberative democracy and then a bit of time in the afternoon with Mentimeters. The other platform that was mentioned was Polis. And so maybe a lot of listeners won't have a clue what Mentimeter and Polis refer to. Could you just touch base on what they are and then maybe give us your takeaway on the deliberative democracy aspect?
At the symposium itself, a tool called Mentimeter was used, and I'm not really an expert on this, but it was really just about enabled people to capture statements and questions and so on and analyze what people were saying. That was used in the session itself, the Mentimeter, and live streamers were able to also use it. So it was fantastic. As we know, you know, on social media, just about everything communication society these days is very much focused on seeding division. And what these tools do is it's all about seeding consensus and finding common ground between people who may have quite different value sets, might support different political parties, but it's all about finding that sort of common ground. So incredibly healthy and an antidote to the seeding of division that we're seeing through so many other aspects of our world, and especially digital world today. Now, Polis was discussed, and again, this is an open source tool. So, and that is the tool that we're proposing to use in a follow-up to this. So you start this conversation off with seed statements. So those seed statements people can see and they can agree or disagree, or they can propose their own. And then eventually you get to a place where you find consensus around different themes. So I actually have here in front of me, Lindsay, a list of potential seed statements that were drawn out of the Mentimeter input from the day. And what Anne has done is then sorted them thematically under things like governance, democracy, economic system, food systems, land use, etc. These can be statements, or they can be questions. And sometimes they're about what needs to happen, and sometimes they are proposing, you know, actions. To give you an example of a seed statement that was offered by a member, you know, someone who was attending under system change/governance, one example is: citizens' assemblies can improve complex decision-making. There are many good examples. Under, for example, food systems, and there were loads of food-producing nation like Aotearoa should be able to provide sufficient healthy food for its own people. What we're likely to do when we launch the Polis is to start off with we think about 50 or so of these seed statements and then work from there and see where it takes us. And just to sort of emphasise, this is entirely participant-led.
For those listeners who are thinking, oh, those statements all sound skewed towards social outcomes, I think we can look on them as challenges, can't we? That here's a statement. It's not saying you have to say, yes, I agree with it. It's a prompt for a discussion around that theme. Am I framing that reasonably?
Exactly. Whether or not we agree or disagree, it's really valuable, very valuable starting point. And so, yes, you're exactly right. It's not about us saying, oh, here are some statements that we're all going to force people to agree with. It's about having a discussion about the statements.
We're rolling towards an election this year. We've got an interview today that I'm like to be centered on climate policy. What policy settings would you most like to see on the table ahead of the coming election? Can you give us a Catherine Knight insight there, please?
So one overall, I guess, statement of the obvious is that it appears, you know, in the last few years, we seem to have completely given up as a country on climate mitigation and are only weakly addressing climate adaptation. So that's got to change quite clearly. So I would like to see immediate measures put in place to reduce climate emissions, emphasising, and I think this is really important, emphasising to New Zealanders that these measures will have meaningful benefits in terms of other aspects of people's lives and the economy, such as the cost of living, public health, environmental health, and it will make us economically more resilient. At a government level, I would like to see a broad suite of incentives and support for the things we want to see more of, such as low carbon transport, more efficient use of energy, reduced food waste, right to repair, and reduced agricultural emissions. And flip side of the incentives, I'd like to see disincentives for the things we want our economy to do less of. So that is fossil fuel consumption, agricultural emissions, waste generation. And just noting, we have one of the highest rates per capita of waste generation in the world. And just a reduction of disincentivizing waste of resources generally. I think we're far too complacent about limited resources, whether it be energy, whether it be water or land, you know, or any other manner of things, in fact. More specifically, the emissions trading scheme, which established to put a price on carbon, is utterly broken. It has been completely undermined by successive government actions and the fact that major greenhouse gas producing sectors are not part of it. And so I think there needs to be a consistent and trusted signal across the economy for the price of carbon so that people, whether it be farmers, whether it be industry or businesses, can invest in the actions that they know will pay off in the long run, both financially and for the climate. And I think this is where we need to see much more maturity in our democratic system and our governance. We need bipartisan commitment to long-term carbon budgets. Ironically, it was the National Environment Minister, National Government Environment Minister Simon Upton, who first proposed a carbon tax in the 1990s. There was major pushback from big industry. I often quip that there's only about three people in all of New Zealand that actually entirely understands the ETS. It's so darn complicated. And I actually don't think that's good for democracy. And just some final thoughts, if I may, Lindsay. I work in the space of transport. And as listeners probably know, that's our single biggest emitting sector. But it's also a fantastic example of where lower emissions measures also bring huge benefits to human health, the economy, and our environment. So by investing more aggressively in public transport and building houses, building homes around existing amenities and public transport, we can and could greatly reduce the need for private vehicle use and also lower costs for households and make people much healthier because they're using their bodies to move around. And finally, also by investing, again, still on transport, by investing more in rail and putting the right pricing in place to encourage the use of rail for freight, we would remove trucks from the road, which create a huge burden on the ratepayer and taxpayer due to the damage that increasingly heavy trucks do to our roads in the form of potholes, which is almost entirely by trucks, not by light vehicles. They are also responsible for the lion's share of air pollution, which prematurely kills between 2,000 and 3,000 New Zealanders every year and makes thousands more sick from respiratory illness and other diseases.
I'm going to say to listeners, please go back and replay that section and keep it in mind when you're going to voting. And just a few little pickup points, if I may. Picking up on heavy trucks, I have an element of sympathy for the heavy transport sector, not because I disagree with what you said, but we make them indispensable in our system. But the damage they cause on the roads, and I'm sure you know this, is sometimes framed as the fourth power rule. And that means that if you have a truck that weighs even just 10 times the mass or weight of a car, it causes 10,000 times the amount of damage. So it's a staggering ratio, isn't it? And my final point, Catherine, is I'd like to put in the plug for well-connected urban cycleways as well, which I think often have a really good return on investment, don't they?
Absolutely. In terms of your comment, Lindsay, on heavy trucks, you're 100% right. And this is an example of where the system is broken and the system, we need transformative system change. The reason why we have so many trucks on the road is that we insist on things, this just-in-time delivery system. We order something on Amazon or Temu and we expect it to be on our doorstep the very next day. And I think we need to move to a more just-in-case system where it's more about resilience. You know, we have stocks of the things that we need locally in case of supply chain disruption to us. So we are part of the problem.
Is this a time for us to move on to your book, Uncommon Land? I'd like to leave it to you to take us through as much of the idea of it and key points and so on as you feel like.
Yeah, so just in case readers are not aware of this book, this is my latest book. I published it last year. And I was very, very fortunate and privileged that it was longlisted in the Ockham Book Awards. So with the book, through the lens of my ancestors' stories, I explore histories of enclosure, resource exploitation, and denaturing that characterise the colonisation of New Zealand and also Ireland and other lands. And ultimately, though, the book is a story of potential, of the wisdom that can be drawn from our ancestors' experience, especially the wisdom of the commons, to help shape a more regenerative, resilient, and equitable future. And I was really overwhelmed by the level of interest in the book and the desire for people to use the stories as a sort of a, just basically as a platform, again, almost like a seeding statement to explore this. And I did feel, I was really felt, again, really lucky that the book seemed to chime with people, seemed to resonate with people. And this was across the spectrum. I think this was because it sits at that intersection between ancestral, you know, family history, which many people have an interest in, with the broader social and economic history, and then the big challenges that we face today.
And if I touch base on your reflections at the end, for example, it picks up on what you've just been saying, and you almost give a two-pronged conclusion out of it. This is how I read it, is that we need a systems change and we need an attitudinal change. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on those, Catherine?
I kind of tie this up with the question you had about it being election year as well. It actually links in with that quite well. So yes, on that, one of the things that I'd really that came through as a very, very strong theme at the symposium too, actually, is that taking responsibility, you know, as individuals for our own climate and ecological footprint is absolutely critical. But where we get the transformational shifts that we need is going to be through system change, which we've sort of already touched on already. And this requires us to mobilize our power as citizens, not just as consumers or individuals, but as citizens. And I believe that we need to be really clear to politicians about what we need to support societal well-being and a resilient future and what we expect from government in that respect. For instance, because I work in transport, to take the transport lens again, people can't take public transport instead of a car if there isn't any public transport. People can't go and build their own buses or trains. This requires government, whether we like it or not. And so it takes government investment. Similarly, we can't live near amenities and the things we need, your schools and, you know, whether it be churches, supermarkets, whatever, if there are no affordable, housing options to do so. And we are forced, as many people are, to live in car dependent suburbia, you know, a long distance away. So again, this is an example of, yes, personal choice is important, but we need government to be making the right investment decisions. And also to a great extent, having the right rules and regulations in place to, again, incentivize the private sector to be doing the things we need as society. Another example of this, Lindsay, is it's really hard to avoid, for example, throwing appliances and household goods away if there is no avenue to repair them, if there's no legislation enforcing the right to repair or putting in place high standards for importers and for manufacturers. Again, this requires government legislation, government regulation. The second thing that I was really keen, you know, on this question about, you know, again, it's election year and what do we want? Again, this was a really central theme at the symposium, was calling out this pernicious myth that the government is like a household, and like a household must balance its books. And this is what I call a convenient untruth. It is a narrative that that suits neoliberal ideology of small government, less regulation, and leaving it to the private sector to deliver on the things that people need. Certainly doesn't work for climate mitigation or adaptation. It doesn't work for environmental protection. It doesn't work for public health. So the market is not going to deliver on those things. In fact, it does quite the opposite, as we know. It creates a lot of damage in those spaces. That would be my two things, that we need collective action and to mobilise our power, which is huge. Our power as citizens, mobilise as citizens, and really push for system change. And the other one is that we must not take the excuse that we're often hearing, especially from this government, oh, we'd like to invest more in public health, or we'd like to invest more in climate mitigation, but we can't afford to. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. We can't afford not to.
Look, once again, Catherine, thank you. That was a very direct and hard-hitting series of statements, and we really need that. And it's in fitting, it's in keeping with the concept of the reality of everything. We are drawing to a close here, but I don't want to finish without making sure that people who have been listening know how they can tap into the recordings, or if they're interested in the Polis program unfolding. Can you please give us a few details there?
Absolutely. So the best place to go to get any updates is to go to the Reality of Everything website, which is all one word, realityofeverything.org.
And there they will be able to stream every one of the morning's presentations, won't they?
Exactly right. And not only that, there are the transcripts are there. That can be downloadable as PDFs, and also the key points. So it's a really succinct summary of the key points from each talk.
Fantastic. You're not somebody just to sit still and think, okay, I've done the reality of everything, now I'm going to stop. So what's next on the radar for Catherine Knight?
And it's really important to emphasise too that we at no point envisaged the Reality of Everything symposium being a one-day thing. Yes, the symposium was on one day, but it was actually all about that being the starting point. Again, a sort of a seeding of further conversation and action. I've been really, really busy, Lindsay, with, you know, building on the momentum created by the symposium, responding to requests for events and so on, making the necessary resources available, some of which we've already talked about, to, you know, enable communities, sector groups, towns and regions to lead these conversations themselves. So another thing that we've already touched on is the Polis survey. So I'll be sort of on the sidelines and helping to it'll be, you know, spearheaded by Anne and Catherine, as I mentioned, our experts. But, you know, I'm going to be very active in rolling out and communicating about that to people and, helping to create the resources and so on. And personally, I'm really excited to learn more about you know, the potential, the potency and the power of deliberative democracy. And I guess another thing I just thought it might worthy of mention, I also, as I perhaps touched on, I work in policy, strategic policy at a regional level, regional government level. And my dream would be for my day job, that job, and my spare time job, and spare time in quote marks, to converge in both creating the space for leadership to support our country to transition towards a more resilient future with human well-being and not unsustainable growth at its fulcrum.
Oh, I've so enjoyed our conversation, as always. It's been really great. I do want to give you a special thanks for your terrific effort and deserved success on the symposium. I was there, as you know, and it was very special. So thanks for that. Thanks for making time to join us, and I look forward to when we intersect in the future.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Well, Catherine does know what she's talking about, doesn't she, and engages across such a wide spread of issues. Coming up in this series, the next up is John Lang. John is also across many different issues. He is a New Zealand barrister who's working in London in climate law. He is also the founder of Kiwis in Climate. He's involved with an Oxford University group on net zero. He's a very accomplished graphic artist and more. And then after that, we have another special event, quite different again. We will be interviewing young people from Lighthouse Aotearoa. That's a Nelson-based organization in linking young people into climate issues and so on. We've had them on before, and I'm so looking forward to talking to them again. So anyway, thank you very much for joining me. I do hope I enjoy your company again next week. And as always, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
This podcast was brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air. Other great local podcasts are available through our website, freshfm.co.nz.